Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. We're still in transition today as we move our studio, so we're going to have some top news stories for you nationally and locally, and then we'll have some of our Best of East County replays for you today. We open our show with an update on the presidential primaries, Senator Sanders' big win in Wyoming, and Senator Ted Cruz coming to San Diego. On Crime Beat, hear about the bust of a burglar inside a fumigated home, and how the U.S. Justice Department freed a housekeeper being held in a human trafficking situation in El Cajon. From Public News Service, hear about a new bill in California to ban rat poison. Now, if you're a nonpartisan voter, you want to listen up today on what you need to do if you want to cast a vote for president in the primary here in San Diego. If you love taking pictures, you'll want to hear about the Lake Jennings photo contest, and we'll have details today. On sports, hear about an injury on the trouble-plagued Padres roster. And we'll have some tips for you on some great places to go hiking with your dogs here in East County and across San Diego. From Public News Service, we'll have some international and national daily news headlines, including a controversy over offshore tax havens in Congress and Pope Francis's recent decisions impacting divorced Catholics and others. On Vines and Wines, we'll be replaying our interview with the owner of the Principe Winery in Ramona. And then on Wildest Jobs, another Best of East County segment is our interview with a rodeo clown in Lakeside. On Bookshelf, hear from author Joyce Strand, who's written a series of mysteries set in the Ramona wine country. From AARP, we'll have a warning about a tax phone scam targeting seniors. And some good news about a new test for the Zika virus developed right here in Spring Valley. We'll have all those stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The Sanders sweep continues. On Saturday, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won the Democratic presidential primary in Wyoming with nearly 56% of the votes in the Cowboy State. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took 44%. The Republican caucus in Wyoming back on March 12th was won by Ted Cruz with 66% of the votes. This was the eighth victory for Sanders in the last nine states to hold primaries or caucuses. Next up is New York on April 19th with 291 Democratic delegates and 95 Republican delegates at stake. Three of the top four contenders have strong ties to New York. New York is Republican Donald Trump's home state. Sanders grew up in Brooklyn, and Hillary Clinton, his Democratic rival, represented New York in Congress. Early polls showed Clinton with a wide lead in New York, but recent polls show Sanders closing the gap. Sanders will take a break from campaigning at a critical time, though, just days before the New York primary. He'll be traveling to the Vatican after accepting an invitation to a Vatican conference on humanitarian issues. Sanders, who is Jewish, has said he admires Pope Francis for his concerns for the poor and for speaking out on income inequality, though he has different views from the Pope on some social issues such as abortion. "I am a big fan of the Pope," Sanders said in an interview on MSNBC. "He's trying to inject this sense of morality into how we do economics, and we need that absolutely desperately." Whether being out of the country 4 days before the critical New York primary will hinder his campaign there or help him with images of Sanders at the Vatican remains to be seen. No Republican primaries or caucuses were held this weekend. However, Texas Senator Ted Cruz scored a big win at the Colorado Republican Convention, securing all 34 of Colorado's delegates. The Colorado results are controversial because the Republican Party there canceled its straw poll and freed up delegates to support any candidate they choose. Donald Trump has blasted the process as unfair since it selects a candidate without any actual voters involved. On Twitter, he said, "The people of Colorado had their vote taken away from them by the phony politicians," adding, "Biggest story in politics." Senator Cruz makes a campaign stop Monday in San Diego, since California, like New York, is a delegate-rich plum that could be influential in determining the outcome in both the Democratic and Republican primaries. Senator Cruz will be speaking at the Town & Country Hotel's Golden Ballroom Monday evening in Mission Valley. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with the Crime Beat Report. Pest control workers are used to dealing with pests, but not of the two-legged variety. On Friday, a worker for a termite control company arrived to remove a fumigation tent from a home in Lakeside and found a human intruder inside. The suspect ran outside and down the street, but the employee followed him in his work truck. Sheriff's deputies responded to a call reporting the burglary and arrested the suspect, Jason Depew, at a nearby intersection. An investigation continues to determine whether Depew could be linked to other recent burglaries of homes being fumigated across the region.
An El Cajon couple has been arrested and charged with forced labor and human trafficking. They are accused of forcing an Indonesian woman to work in their El Cajon home as a housekeeper for up to 18 hours a day without pay. The victim was rescued after she gave a note to a visiting nurse asking for help, the U.S. Justice Department has announced. Firas Majid and Shahar Abbas were arraigned Friday and are set for a preliminary hearing April 21st. If convicted, they could face up to 20 years in prison and $250,000 fine. U.S. Attorney Laura Duffy praised the victim for having the courage to seek help and the healthcare workers who responded to her note. Duffy said, "Human trafficking is a deplorable practice that amounts to modern slavery, and many of these victims are hiding in plain sight." She added, "We all need to work together to recognize the signs and put a stop to this devastating crime." The charges include allegations that Majid and Abbas threatened the victim with physical restraint if she would not perform labor and services. They're also alleged to have concealed her passport to restrict her freedom to leave or to travel. The victim reported she was previously held at a home belonging to relatives of Abbas in Dubai and the United Arab Emirates. In Dubai, the victim was allegedly required to provide domestic services for 20 hours a day every day for 5 years, and she was not paid a salary. Then in November of last year, she was ordered to travel to the U.S. and work at the home of Majid and Abbas in El Cajon. Here, she was forced to provide domestic services, including cleaning and laundry, for the entire household for 16 to 18 hours every day, according to the complaint. The victim reported she received no days off or pay for her services. The victim speaks no English, had no money, and was not allowed to leave except to throw away the family's trash. The victim was removed from the residence on March 22nd by agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Homeland Security Investigations. Healthcare workers reported to the National Human Trafficking Resource Center that the victim was seen in the back of the residence and closely monitored. Agents translated her note requesting help, which the victim had provided to a visiting nurse, and that's what prompted the rescue. Victims of labor trafficking are often overwhelmed by fear and fail to report crimes against them. Often, victims are unfamiliar with U.S. culture. They may be unaware of their rights or have been intentionally misinformed about rights in America. Many don't speak English and are unable to communicate with service providers, police, or others who may be able to help them. They often blame themselves for their predicaments. Many are not legally in the U.S., and they have a fear of being arrested or deported. Even victims who have been beaten or raped sometimes feel their current situation is still better than where they came from. They may be afraid that speaking out could result in harm to families in their home countries who often are threatened by the traffickers. And for all those reasons, these cases are tremendously difficult to investigate and prosecute, the Justice Department says. Dave Shaw, the special agent in charge of Homeland Security for San Diego, says the arrests here in El Cajon bring to light the sad reality of modern-day slavery. He concludes, forced labor, which often involves individuals who are held in isolation, degraded, and most alarming, stripped of their basic human freedom, has no place in a modern society. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Dozens of people rallied in Sacramento on Tuesday to support a bill that would ban certain kinds of rat poison. The protest took place across the street from the annual meeting of the California Pest Control Operators, which opposes the bill, called AB 2596. Most rat poison was pulled from store shelves last year, but it is still widely used by professional pest control companies. Lisa Owens-Viani, with a conservation group called Raptors Are the Solution, says secondary poisonings are a huge problem.
When an owl or a hawk or a mountain lion, bobcat, the domestic cat, when they eat a rat that has been poisoned, they also become poisoned because the rat poison is very, very toxic.
Advocates suggest homeowners go back to traditional methods, such as getting a cat or using a snap trap. There are also electronic traps that go inside of bait boxes. People should also remove anything that may be attracting rats to the property, like fallen fruit or pet food. Owens-Viani also notes that 8,500 children were accidentally sickened by rodenticides in 2014 in the U.S., many after bait was placed in high-traffic areas such as public housing units.
A lot of times they're flavored like chocolate or peanut butter, and little kids can pick up the bait and eat it. They end up in the emergency room. Usually doesn't kill kids, although it has in a couple of instances.
Wildlife officials have documented poisonings in at least 37 different types of animals. 26 California cities and counties have passed resolutions urging the public and pest control operators to avoid rodent poisons. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. If you are registered as a nonpartisan voter and received a vote-by-mail ballot, but you want to vote for president in the June primary, the Registrar of Voters needs to hear from you. Nonpartisan ballots won't list any presidential candidates, so if you'd like to cast a vote for president, the Registrar needs to send you a different mail ballot. The Registrar of Voters office sent out over 300,000 postcards to nonpartisan vote-by-mail voters in early March to let them know they have choices if they want to vote for president. They can request a mail ballot for one of three political parties, American Independent, Democratic, or Libertarian. Those parties are allowing nonpartisan voters to take part in their elections. Selecting one of those political party ballots will not permanently change your party registration, but will allow you to vote for the presidential candidate of any one of those parties for the June 7th presidential primary election. Choose which of these party ballots you'd like to receive for the primary on the postage-paid postcard and return it by April 13th. And if you can't find that postcard, you can call the Registrar's office at area code 858-565-5800. Now, if you want to vote for a presidential candidate in the Green, Republican, or Peace and Freedom Party, you'll need to re-register with that party before May 23rd, because they allow only registered members of their parties to take part in their presidential primary elections. You can re-register to vote online at registertovote.ca.gov. If your signature is confirmed through Department of Motor Vehicles records, it will automatically be sent to the Registrar of Voters office. If the signature is not confirmed, print the form, sign it, and mail it to the registrar, or you can drop it off in person at the registrar's office in Kearny Mesa. By state law, the registrar must have your original signature. For more information, you can call 858-565-5800, or you can visit sdvote.com.
Attention photographers, Lake Jennings is sponsoring a photo contest and giving away passes to photographers who want to enjoy the lake and take photos to enter in the contest. Photos in the contest must be taken between March 1st and May 31st of this year. The entry deadline is May 31st, with categories for children and adults, plus prizes up to $100 for the winning entries. It's a beautiful time of year to head out to Lake Jennings and Lakeside, a lake with beautiful mountain views, yet it's easily accessible to urban dwellers in our region. The lake is a popular fishing spot, also enjoyed by hikers, campers, and kayakers. It's rich in wildlife such as deer and waterfowl. If you're very fortunate, you may even see a pair of bald eagles that have recently begun frequenting Lake Jennings, one of East County's hidden treasures. You can learn more about the lake and the photo contest at lakejennings.org. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Liz Alper with a sports report for East County Magazine on KNSJ. The Padres announced today that starting pitcher Tyson Ross is now on the 15-day disabled list, retroactive to April 5th, the Union Tribune reports. The Padres say that Ross suffered shoulder inflammation. This clears a spot for newly acquired pitcher Brad Hand. There is no timetable for Ross as of yet, but the Padres announced that James Shields will take his place for Sunday's finale against Colorado.
Spring is a beautiful time to hit the trail and bring your dog along. The good news is that dogs are allowed at all county parks except Agua Caliente and Wilderness Gardens Preserve. Assistants or guide dogs are always welcome at all parks as long as they are in compliance with the regulations and check in with the park staff. Here are some tips to make your hike enjoyable and safe for both you and your dog. First, plan out your hike. Know your dog's fitness level so you can match that with the length of trail and type of terrain you choose. You can check out trails online at the County Parks and Recreation Department. Second, be sure your dog is up to date on vaccines and have a collar or been treated to prevent ticks and fleas. Also, make sure your four-legged friend has current ID tags and a well-fitted collar in case you get separated. If your dog does become lost, contact the County of San Diego Department of Animal Services. Make sure the time of day you choose to hike with your dog is appropriate, avoiding hot temperatures. Unless you hike with your dog often and they are used to this type of rigorous exercise, they could succumb to heat exhaustion. Dogs are more susceptible to heat stroke than humans. Also, if the ground is too hot for your hand, it's too hot for your dog's paws. Always have plenty of water for both you and your dog. It's better to bring along a little extra than not enough. You might also want to pack a few doggy treats and search for a shaded area to take your breaks. Be sure to stay on the marked trail. In all county parks, dogs are required to be kept on a leash no longer than 6 feet in length at all times. A leash prevents dogs from becoming lost and also helps protect them from having an unexpected encounter with a rattlesnake, mountain lion, a sick or injured animal. Make sure to maintain control of your dog at all times. Dogs that are out of control or that pose a demonstrated risk to others may be asked to leave by a park ranger. Always clean up after your dog to allow everyone to enjoy our parks. If you decide to make it a weekend or an overnight in a county park with camping, the fee for dogs in camping parks is just $1 per dog per night. You will need to provide current license and vaccination information as well. Hiking with your dog in a county park is a great way to get some exercise and enjoy a change of pace from your usual walks around the neighborhood. So follow these tips, enjoy your hike, and get plenty of bonding time with your pup. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, April 11th, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. Here's a look at the stories we're featuring today. Congress to get an earful on offshore tax havens, mandatory minimum sentences deliberated in Massachusetts, and a new document from Pope Francis signals changes, but not enough for some. At the top of the list, a week after a leak of more than 11 million documents from a law firm in Panama that reportedly helped set up offshore accounts for the rich and powerful, various groups are headed to D.C. this week to urge Congress to tighten laws that allow anonymous shell companies in the U.S. Mark Richardson reports.
The groups from across the country want Congress to establish federal regulations to make corporate ownership more transparent, since current laws vary widely from state to state. Anna Owens with the Arizona Public Interest Research Group says shell companies generally only serve criminals and others trying to hide what they're doing.
We're trying to take the anonymous part out of it. We're trying to make sure that when someone goes to create a corporation or a company, they're required to disclose who actually owns or controls that company.
The Reverend Leanna Rowe with Shadow Rock United Church of Christ in Phoenix and Thal Naralnik, a Phoenix CPA, are leading a delegation from Arizona as part of the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency, or FACT, Coalition. Owen says the group is pushing lawmakers to adopt the Incorporation Transparency and Law Enforcement Assistance Act, designed to make every company disclose its true owners. She says they also are backing a bill designed to close the loopholes that allow corporations and wealthy Americans to hide income using offshore havens.
President Barack Obama said Sunday the worst mistake of his presidency was a lack of planning for the aid and governing of Libya in the aftermath of the 2011 toppling of the country's dictator. The operation and its chaotic aftermath has been resurrected in the 2016 presidential campaign. That's in part because of the increasing presence of the Islamic State there and U.S. airstrikes to disrupt its operation. Back here in the States, opponents of mandatory minimum sentences say they undermine justice by taking away the discretion of judges. States and the federal government have varying required sentences. And in Massachusetts, it's up to the state's highest court to determine whether a judge there in a drug case can impose a sentence lower than the mandatory minimum under state law. More from Mike Clifford.
The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court heard oral arguments last week. ACLU of Massachusetts legal director Matt Siegel argues that judges can depart from mandatory minimum sentences because of a 1996 state law that created a legal safety valve.
And in Massachusetts, the safety valve permits judges in cases involving mitigating facts to impose sentences below the otherwise applicable mandatory minimum. And here there were mitigating facts.
The case at issue is Commonwealth versus Lalta Prasad. Siegel says the judge in that case was right in giving the defendant a lesser sentence because he possessed only a small amount of drugs and was facing major health problems at the time of the offense. The state argued the judge should not be allowed to depart from the mandated minimum drug sentence because the state legislature failed to pass needed guidelines.
Pope Francis got the attention of American Catholics on Friday with the release of a document called Amoris Laetitia, or The Joy of Love. In the document, Pope Francis asked priests and bishops to be more lenient on people who have divorced and are looking to remarry. However, Marianne Duty Burke of Dignity USA, a Catholic organization committed to LGBT equality, says she's not pleased with the Pope's message that same-sex marriage is not equal to other kinds of marriage.
There's no recognition of the value of our relationships, no sense of grace that can be in them. And it talks about families having LGBT members as essentially having to deal with a burden.
Francis released The Joy of Love after meeting with the world's Catholic bishops last October. Long before the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin became the first community in the nation to replace all lead water pipes. And as Tim Morrissey reports, the state's becoming a national leader.
Several other Wisconsin communities, including Green Bay, Wausau, Kaukauna, Marshfield, and others, either have replacement programs underway or are exploring the cost. The Environmental Protection Agency now looks to Wisconsin, specifically to Madison, for information that will help other communities across the nation dealing with lead pipes. Amy Berrio, the Madison Water Utility, says there are so many elements involved.
And I think it all points to the very critical issue of aging water infrastructure in this country. It's not just lead. It's so many things that we really need to look at.
Now the Madison Water Utility is able to share expertise to help other communities undertaking the project.
The Florida legislature's $200 million funding for projects in the Everglades is getting praise from conservation groups, and they say it will benefit people just as much as the native wildlife.
Beth Lewis, director of water resources for the Nature Conservancy's Florida chapter, says some of the most critical projects can now move forward, and they will have a far-reaching effect.
It helps rehydrate those natural areas on the coast that provide resilience against sea level rise, against hurricane impacts that we have in Florida.
Lewis says the funding will support river and lake improvement projects and ensure the health of the Floridan aquifer, which runs under the entire state, Deborah Kay reporting.
The world's count of wild tigers roaming forests has gone up for the first time in more than a century, with some 3,890 counted by conservation groups and national governments in the latest global census. The tally marks a turnaround from the last worldwide estimate in 2010, when the number of tigers in the world hit an all-time low of about 3,200. That's according to the World Wildlife Fund and the Global Tiger Forum. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener-supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to Vines and Wines with your host, Greg Maness of the Maness Vineyards Estate.
Hello, San Diego. Welcome to Vines and Wines. It's a radio show that introduces you to many of the rising new superstars and energized people in the local wine industry that will forever change the landscape of San Diego as it emerges into a brand new EVA wine growing district.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. And today I am guest hosting the Vines and Wines segment on our show, and we are on location in Ramona's Highland Valley, the heart of wine country up here. And our very special guest today is Alfredo Gallone with the Principe de Tricase Winery. Alfredo, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So I understand that your family has a very illustrious lineage in Italy with its roots in Greece. Tell us about that.
My family moved from Greece in the 1500s to southern Italy. And because at that time southern Italy was attacked on the coastline from the African tribes, my ancestor organized protection for the coastline. And the king of Naples heard about this valor and named him as Principe di Tricase. And so the lineage started with him.
So he was recognized for his heroism by being named the prince of all the lands that he was protecting. That is amazing. Now, I also understand that your winery here specializes in a grape called Aglianico, which originated in Greece but is no longer grown there. It's grown in Italy, and now you're bringing it here to Southern California in Ramona. Tell us what is so special about the Aglianico grape and wine.
Well, we produce here three grapes, Aglianico, Aleatico, and Nebbiolo. And we're just starting with some Petit Syrah, but mostly are Italian grapes that are very old, ancient grapes. The Aglianico was used by the Romans to go around and to plant new grapes everywhere because it was very hardy. And the wine mostly was capable of traveling versus other wines that are more delicate.
I'm told that the Aleatico was the favored wine of a very famous person in history.
The Aleatico was the wine that Napoleon used to drink when he was a prisoner at the island of Elba. And if you go on Wikipedia, you'll find out more about him loving the wines and being happy to drink that kind of a specialty wine, which is available here now in Ramona and is made the same ancient way it was made then today.
Amazing. It's really one of the most unusual wines I've ever tasted. Can you tell us about that?
The Aleatico has the rose flavor and smell and is just coming out of the glass when you pour it without any addition whatsoever to the grape itself or to the wine. It's just a natural smell, which is really, really amazing.
You also have a wine called Romantico that's a dessert wine. Can you give us some details?
Yes, the Romantico is the same Aleatico grapes dried out in the sun after harvest and then squeezed. It's a very particular wine with a strong aroma, beautiful for dessert, a little high in alcohol, but it will really give you a romantic evening.
Well, thank you for sharing that information.
We also, from the skin of the Aglianico, Aunt B Botanicals makes a cream that is used for botanical clay mask or for preserving, supposedly preserving from aging.
Amazing. Okay. Now, I see that a lot of your wine bottles here have medals hanging around them. Tell us about some of the awards that you've won.
In the last 2 or 3 years, after my wine started, to my taste, was kind of good. I didn't know if it was just me that I liked it or if it was a good wine. So I sent for competitions all over the country, and I won like 12 medals in 2 years.
Very good, including some impressive ones, Finger Lakes International Competition in New York, to name one of them. I understand that you're only making these right now in very small batches, so how do people get these wines?
Our production is very limited, and we make around 6,000 bottles of wine every year. So we will be able to sell it through membership and through club membership only to maybe 200 or 300 people that will enroll to our club membership, and that's how we distribute our wine.
Okay, so that's through pineandwine.com.
Yes, or they can call me on the phone numbers that are listed on the web. And to you listeners, if you mention that you heard about this interview and you come to us, I'll make sure you'll be very happy and surprised with some special treatment. Thank you.
Well, that's very kind. Now, you also grow Christmas trees. Tell us a little bit about how you got into that.
Well, when I bought the property here in Ramona in 2007, it was a Christmas tree farm. And I was here when the last year the former owner was selling the last of his trees. So everybody that came begged me to keep the Christmas tree farm open. And so we have pine with the Christmas tree and wine with the grapes, and we have pineandwine.com, and we still are open to sell the Christmas tree at Christmas time.
Well, very good. And if people want to come and do tastings, I understand that it's by appointment only right now. Is that correct?
Yes, we are open by appointment. You can go on our website and pineandwine.com, and my number is there. You can call me, and anytime I'm up here, I'll be happy to open up for you and show you my winery, taste my wine from barrel or from bottles.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ.
Thank you very much for coming.
Cheers.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Working hard to bring you the wildest jobs in East County. Today, Cody and I went to Lakeside. There we met a man who's going to explain why his workday is more interesting than yours, or at least more likely to end up in a trip, to the hospital. I'm here today with Kevin Higley, who is a rodeo clown. Kevin, how long have you been doing rodeo clowning?
Ooh, that's a dated question, huh? You're going to make me tell how old I am is what you're trying to get at, right? No, I've been actually a professional rodeo clown for 30 years. Prior to that, I participated in high school rodeo and as a contestant, and then I started doing what we call amateur rodeos as a rodeo clown bullfighter, and then I got my pro card and went on to the professional ranks, and so I've been it for, I bet you, total almost 35 years.
So you were doing professional rodeo as what prior to doing the clown part of it?
I was. I tried to be a bull rider. Thought maybe I could make a profession out of it and a living. Wasn't very good at that. So what it came to be was my brother was a really good bull rider, and we had what they call a practice pen at home where we buck some bulls and stuff. And so we took turns being the bullfighter who would save the bull rider. Well, boy, I saved him a whole lot more than he ever thought of saving me. And so it became apparent that I was probably a little bit more adapted to the bullfighting area and saving the cowboys. And that was really the love and passion that I had once I got started, that, you know, the thrill of saving a guy so you can get on to another one is really something else. And as time went on, of course, you slow down a couple steps. Not me, but my mind may. I don't know. But anyway, so then I transferred into the rodeo clown / barrel man type aspect of the professional rodeo deal.
Now, you use the term bull fighting, which seems more appropriate to me somehow. So here's another question for you. I've noticed that bulls don't seem to have a lot of sense of humor. So have you actually made one ever laugh?
Oh, yeah, they're always smiling when they run over you. Yeah, well, they've got a smile. You know, a lot of people, they used to say that a bull will actually close his eyes before he runs over you. But that's not true. I can attest to that. They're wide open, and they are laughing. It's like, I got you, buddy. It's good.
So the natural follow-up to that is, how many bones have you had broken?
That's one we don't like to discuss very much. But, you know, I've been really fortunate in my career to stay away from most of the broken bones. I fractured a couple neck vertebrae, and I've had a couple of bones in my foot broke and a couple of things like that. But as a whole, I've been really healthy and really good.
Do you really like to use the word whole when you're talking about bulls and horns and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you got to watch that. That one puts you in a hole.
Now, I'm sure that people, not necessarily associated with rodeo, but people on the outside probably think that you would do this for the thrills. What kind of satisfaction do you get from actually doing this work?
That's a great question. You know, like I said early on, is just the satisfaction that you've did something to help somebody else to be able to further their career and go on and stuff. So saving a bull rider from a bull or helping him, assisting him to be a higher score, that's where it starts. And that now it's the thrill of entertainment, you know, making people laugh. I just love to hear them giggle and laugh. And so that part is where I'm at now in my career. So we do it for the love, because, you know, unlike a lot of professional sports, the money isn't probably as as good as your football, your baseball, your basketball players, but it also is an aspect of it. We do it for the money as well.
Yeah, so you're as a professional rodeo, I see that you have a big trailer, so you travel around from rodeo to rodeo?
I do. Throughout the course of this year, I'll probably be in at least 15 states. I guess the farthest away, which my trailer wasn't able to go with me and a lot of my animals wasn't, was Hawaii. We've actually did rodeos in Hawaii on two of the islands over there.
Oh, really? So you did go to Hawaii, but you just didn't float your trailer across?
No, trailer stayed home as well as my animals that I use in my clown acts, yeah.
Okay, so you do an act out on the in the arena with your own animals. I see you have a dog over there. Is that one of your...
Yeah, I've actually got three or four dogs, and I've got a trick horse, trick mule. You know, sometimes the kids become my tricks. You know, I'm very enthusiastic about getting the crowd involved, and so we use the kids a lot of times in some of the things we do.
If I ever were to find myself in a field with a pissed-off bull, because, you know, that happens to me a lot. Give me some ideas for how to sort of distract the guy.
Well, you know, so the best thing to do is, of course, it's not all about how fast you can outrun them. It's about the move that you can make to get around them. Because they've got a big old body and they got to bend in half to get to back to where you are. So what you want to do is you want to kind of get in as close as possible and then make that move to the inside and keep them coming. And then when you get to break, you break them so they're on a different lead and you can get away from them.
So you have to fight every instinct, natural instinct, to turn around and run. You have to get close to them, right next to them, in order to be safe.
You're sure better off. Yeah, you're better off. I mean, I know that my legs have never stood around for my face to take a beating, you know. And so it's kind of a natural instinct to run, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of different things you use. The apparel that we wear, the things we wear that gets their attention, that will bring them in your direction, and then it's up to you to make the move to bring them away from the cowboy and to get yourself away.
Okay. Now, professional football players, you mentioned them. They're always complaining about having a short career. Now, you've been doing this for a while. How long would you say the average rodeo clown sort of stays in the profession?
You know, and I guess that would be a term that's kind of tough to use, average, because I don't know any of us that are too, you know. And I guess the guy that kind of I look up to and kind of was my mentor, taught me a little bit, was a guy by the name of Wick Path. And he actually fought bulls at an active level, professional level, till he was 57 years old. It's all about how physically fit you stay. We've got a guy in the business right now that's strictly entertainment. He doesn't even get in the barrel anymore or do any of those things to help out. And he's 78 years old and very active and doing a great job.
Okay, well, see, my son here is, let's say that he goes to see his guidance counselor at school, and the guidance counselor, I've noticed, doesn't have any posters on the wall of rodeos or anything.
No.
But let's say that she says that she's changed her mind and he should forget about engineering and all of that, and he should become a rodeo clown. What advice would you give him for getting into this job, apart from why don't you do something safe like join the Navy SEALs?
Yeah, there we go. Two safe jobs. Well, I'll tell you what the first thing I would do with modern day rodeo, we have schools, and the best thing to do for someone that's inspiring to be a rodeo clown or a bullfighter or a participant, a contestant, is to search out one of those schools and go spend a week, 3 days, whatever the school is, and actually get a head start on what they really could do and if they're adapted for that.
Do you know of any women who do this job who are rodeo clowns?
You know, there used to be, years ago, there was a lady that actually didn't actually do the bullfighting part of the clown, but she got in the barrel, and she would tell a few jokes and do stuff. But that was a long time ago. Right at this present time, I don't know anybody, any ladies. I think it has to do with intelligence.
Oh, okay. That's an excellent point. Cody, you have a question?
Yeah, what's the deal with the barrels? What exactly do you do with barrels?
Okay, the barrel is out there for a particular reason. We had put it out in the middle of the arena. Actually, not quite the middle of the arena. It's a little closer to the bucking chutes. And it really becomes kind of like a safe haven for the bullfighters or the bull riders. In case that bull is coming at them, they're caught out in no man's land. They can come there, catch the breath, get away, or at least the bull will be distracted so they can move on. It's my job as a barrel man to position my barrel in a place which will help assist the bullfighters and the bull rider to be able to have a little bit more safety. So, and it's really like sitting in a washing machine just waiting for somebody to turn that thing on, the spin cycle. Because when one of those guys hits it, it can really turn your world upside down.
So it sounds like your job is more about strategy than it is about, I mean, obviously on YouTube or on TV, what they like to show is rodeo clowns being tossed and trampled and all that. But the object is to avoid that and to protect the cowboys and to entertain the crowd, basically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a given that you're going to be in a very bad situation most of the time because, you know, you've got an unpredictable animal. He's going to do what he wants to do. He's going to do his. So you're going to be put in a position where you're going to get in there that you're probably going to get what they call hooked and thrown out of there. But the better that you prepare yourself to be able to make yourself in the right position to walk away from that, the longer your career will be.
So you're kind of like the ninjas of the West, is what you're telling me.
I've never had it put that way, but yeah, cowabunga, dude, let's do it.
Okay, Cody?
So is it true about bulls that they don't like red, like don't like red capes? Is that true?
Great question. You know, and it really is a myth. It doesn't have to do with the red cape that the matadors you see, if the matadors are fighting, or like in our case, we wear bandanas a lot of times on our deals. It's all about the movement. It's the movement of something that brings their attention to it. And that's why when you see the guys with the capes and the matadors, and they can stand in one spot, but the bull will follow a cape and follow that deal.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the people of East County?
Boy golly, if they get a chance, come to the rodeo. They're going to enjoy it.
So, Cody, now that you've seen a little bit of what life as a rodeo clown is like, are you ready to reconsider your future?
No, because as much as my counselors say that I should quit any field that involves thinking, I think I should steer clear of this kind of career.
Are you saying that you don't want to get involved in something that can cow you this much?
You know, I have a lot of beef with you saying something that mean about me, Dad.
Well, I would say that right now my attitude is the lasso your problems.
I just don't know if I'm capable of learning the ropes on this exciting career.
Well, son, that sounds like a lot of bull to me because I don't know anyone who clowns around as much as you do. This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Clocking out of one of the wildest jobs in East County.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
Today I'm speaking with Joyce Strand, author of Hilltop Sunset, the first of a new series about a financial guru transitioning from executive to winemaker. My guest has written three previous mysteries on message, open meetings, and fair disclosure. She also writes and publishes a blog, Strand's Simply Tips, and she's a reporter for a regional wine magazine. Welcome, Joyce. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, and also thank you so much for doing Bookshelf. It's awesome that local authors have a place where they can talk about their books, and I thank
you're
you
welcome.
For featuring me.
You're welcome. No one's ever said that on my show. I appreciate that. Okay, let's begin with your new series. Your protagonist, Bryn Bancroft, is a minor character from your three mysteries. Tell us about those mysteries. And what made Bryn branch out into her own story in Hilltop Sunset? Give us some perspective.
Okay. Well, first of all, the first three mysteries featured Gillian Hillcrist as the protagonist. Gillian was a public relations executive at a Silicon Valley company, which has a familiar ring to it because, yes, indeed, that's what I did for almost 30 years.
What a coincidence, yes.
But at any rate, she encountered a variety of crimes in these three books, but always there and always present was her boss. And her boss was Bryn Bancroft, who was the chief financial officer at the company where Gillian worked. And as Gillian became more pulled into the mystery, so did Bryn. And so Bryn always had a role in helping Gillian solve the mysteries. Mm-hmm. But she also, in the third book in particular, gets really involved as a victim as well. And so she was just crying out. She had her own personality, which we discover very early on in the first book when Bryn accidentally walks in on her and the CEO doing the baddie. And so we learn really quickly about Bryn's character, which evolves over those three books and then definitely morphs into a new character in Hilltop Sunset. But she absolutely is a character worthy of being a protagonist.
Okay, she demanded a book.
She demanded it, yes. Absolutely.
Well, I'm interested, you know, now you said that you were a public relations executive. You worked in biotech and high-tech companies in Silicon Valley. But unlike Gillian, your protagonist from the first three mysteries, you never encountered murder. Right?
Right.
So why murder?
True enough.
What is it that you enjoy about writing murder mysteries? And what's challenging about it?
Well, first of all, I think I started reading mysteries myself when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe younger. I can't remember when I read my first Nancy Drew. But for sure, I have read mysteries all my life. Okay, I've read other stuff too, but mysteries are my favorite.
Yeah.
When it came time after my most recent layoff, which happens in Silicon Valley a lot, mm-hmm. I got to the point where it was difficult to find a job, and I was sitting around moping. My now late husband said, well, why don't you write a book? And I said, well, what do you mean write a book? And I'm thinking he wants me to write nonfiction, which is what I've done throughout my career, mm-hmm. you know, written various articles about biotech and high tech and whatever. But he says, nah, write a mystery. You read enough of them. And right. So that's literally how it got started. And then trying to figure out, well, what am I going to write? Okay, I've read a lot of mysteries, but how do I create a mystery? And so I looked around and I thought, well, I don't know. And I read a few newspapers because that's what you do when you're in public relations. Mm-hmm. You read a lot of publications. And I saw, my goodness, there's a lot of crime in California. So I figured, you know, that's where I'm going to get my stories. All of my stories are pulled from real crimes that happened and have happened in Silicon Valley.
Really?
And in fact, some of the perpetrators are still in prison, doing time for their crime. But that was how I evolved my plot, if you will, my story. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge then becomes, well, you don't know anything about mysteries or solving murders or even what happens with the murder.
You're not a detective.
So I'm not a detective. So how do I make it credible? And I looked around and I found out that I had several friends among my list of friends who were policemen. And I also found a retired FBI agent who actually gave me the plot for Hilltop Sunset. He recommended it, and it was a case that he worked on. So that helped me. That challenge was met by reaching out to real experts in the field who could help me make sure that my police procedure was credible. Example, I had a police officer, detective, show up in the first two books anyway, to help solve that mystery. Well, it turns out that in San Francisco, they don't call their detectives. They call them inspectors.
Yeah,
and they're one of the few.
Yeah.
And they're one of the, it's a minor detail, but it does add to the credibility.
Sure. So, can you tell us very briefly the real story of the crime that you based your new book on?
Oh, if I do that, it's a
It'll
spoiler.
It'll be a spoiler?
Yeah,
okay,
it's a spoiler.
Let's not have a spoiler. Okay, how about this? I know that you're a wine connoisseur. Your new book is set in California wine country, and you write for a wine magazine. Tell us what you love about California's wine and wine country, and how do you do your research for that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure connoisseur is the right word. I certainly do drink a lot of wine. We'll
get
to that.
A wine lover.
Yes, I'm a wine lover, I guess. You know, it's interesting. I grew up in a household that we probably didn't drink wine. In fact, I know we didn't drink wine, and more or less probably because it was too expensive. And I came from the East Coast and got married and moved to California. I moved to California at a time when the state wine industry was just beginning, particularly Napa and Sonoma, just beginning to be famous and well-regarded. So living in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, that's the wine I drank. That's how I learned to drink wine, was Napa Sonoma. All of the names that are famous now were just coming along then. Well, then we moved to Ramona. And we moved to Ramona in 2007, just as Ramona was starting to do its wine industry. And so I watched and have participated and enjoyed watching the Ramona wineries grow. You know, there's now 26 tasting rooms in Ramona. I have to say that.
Or really?
My winery friends will get on me. And the wine is superb, and it's growing. The industry's growing. You can go out and taste at a beautiful setting. And so, yes, wine has become a part of my living, part of my life. And it is such fun to move out of the corporate environment, which is where Jillian Hillcrest was, and this is another reason I wanted Bryn, and move into the winemaking industry and start thinking about, well, how do you make wine? And yes, I do need to do research.
And you go to the wineries.
I go to the wineries.
Fun.
I mean, I don't want to make a silly mistake like explaining why you would do stainless steel instead of oak barrels, which any novice might know. So, yes, I am, and I'm doing more research as we get into the Bryn books because she becomes more and more experienced with making wine.
It sounds like fun.
Oh, it is. Love it.
I know that you're currently working on the second Bryn Bancroft mystery, but you're also writing an historical novel about a judge in 1939 California. Give us a hint about which judge this is and what real-life event you're dramatizing for us.
Actually, I'm very excited about this. It's a book that I've been wanting to write ever since I started writing it, but because I set it in a 1939 Ventura, by the way, Ventura, okay, California, I needed to do a lot of research, and I spent a lot of time up in Ventura at their museum library doing research. I've read all newspapers, daily newspapers from 1939 to get a feel for that, that time period. But it's based on a memoir of the grandfather of a friend of mine, and he brought it to me. And this was a judge. The memoir actually ended in 1942, although he became a Superior Court judge then and then continued on for another 20 years. And it's based on his life, but it is fictionalized. The cases that I pull in are some of his own that he actually did as a lawyer as opposed to a judge. He was very careful not to talk about his cases as a judge, as you can imagine. So it is based on his values. Some of the cases are from him, but it's a story about, a fictionalized story of one of his cases that involves a witness at his trial who is actually a 16-year-old precocious wannabe writer. And the two of them team up because this particular judge was very much into juvenile rehabilitation as opposed to juvenile punishment.
Interesting.
And so the values that are espoused for this particular judge, the fictional character, are the values of my friend's grandfather, but it's not really him.
Right.
But it was interesting to figure out how to write a book when you couldn't say that they had a cell phone to check on or an internet to
very
find
different
information.
Very so, different.
But and a different kind of challenge.
But it inspired you.
Right. That book should come out in mid-year.
Well, that leads to my last question. When should we expect to see the sequel to Hilltop Sunset?
The second of the three, I'm doing three books in that series, should come out in November of 2015, this year. And I do want to add that I am introducing a character from Ramona, who will be a minor character in the next two Bryn Bancroft books, but then I will spin her off into a series, and they will be set in Ramona.
They're all demanding, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They are very demanding. Yes, indeed.
Well, Joyce, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and again, thank you for doing this.
For more information on Joyce Strand and her work, please visit her website at joycestrand.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
California has seen a huge surge in reports of threatening or aggressive phone scams in this income tax filing season, according to experts with AARP's Fraud Watch Network. This year, the group is warning of several types of scams. In one version, a person will call and pretend to be from the Internal Revenue Service and will sometimes begin to bully the consumer, demanding payment. Amy Knopfziger with the AARP Fraud Watch Network says the IRS will never call without having contacted the taxpayer first by mail and will never threaten to involve the police, arrest you, or deport you.
The IRS will never require that you use a specific payment method, such as a prepaid debit card, wire transfer, money order. We've even heard of scammers asking for people to go and get gift cards.
She says identity theft tends to spike this time of year when scammers use a person's stolen birth date and social security number to try and intercept their income tax refund. Knopfziger advises people to use a locked mailbox and never leave outgoing mail that contains personal information on it in the mailbox. Instead, take it directly to the post office. And beware what you leave in your trash can.
Always shred your personal and private information and use a confetti shredder, because there are people that have a lot of time on their hands that will sit there and put those pieces of paper back together.
If you need help filing your taxes, AARP's free tax aid program helped more than 187,000 people file their income tax returns last year. Get more information or find a tax aid location on the AARP.org website. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Miriam Raftery with an exciting health update right here in East County. A Spring Valley company, CalBiotech Inc., has just announced that it has come out with the United States' first immunoassay kits to detect antibodies against Zika virus in human blood. The Zika virus was first isolated back in 1947 in a rhesus monkey during a yellow fever study in Uganda's Zika forest. The virus has since spread via the yellow fever mosquito to tropical and subtropical regions around the world. Officials estimate up to 1.5 million people have contracted Zika virus in Brazil alone. And as of March, Zika has spread to over 40 countries, including 273 cases in the U.S., David Barca, the vice president of CalBiotech, says, "I am proud of our team's collaborative effort to work quickly and diligently to develop this very important diagnostic tool that will aid doctors and researchers in their efforts to control this outbreak. Zika virus infection causes no symptoms in many patients, making it very difficult to get an early diagnosis. When illness does occur, the symptoms are usually mild, with rash, fever, conjunctivitis, or joint pain. Only 20% of people infected show any of those symptoms, which can last a few days to a week after they're stung by an infected mosquito. But recent studies indicate Zika virus can cause abnormal development in fetuses, resulting in miscarriage or babies born with severe microcephaly, a serious condition in which the baby's head and brain are severely underdeveloped. Due to the potential link between Zika virus infection and microcephaly, the World Health Organization in February declared a public health emergency of international concern. Here in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control conclude there are multiple cases of Zika virus being transmitted from person to person now, typically through sexual contact or from mother to child during pregnancy or birth, not just mosquitoes. Both these scenarios emphasize the importance of an accurate diagnostic. CalBiotech Scientific Director Jonas Johannes observes, "The Summer Olympics in Brazil, combined with the upcoming mosquito season, may accelerate the spread of Zika virus to a global scale. As the disease spreads, more efficient diagnostics will be needed." Now, the company is working on developing additional ways to advance critical diagnostics. CalBiotech's Zika virus kits can determine if a patient is infected using only 10 microliters of serum or plasma, delivering results in less than an hour. CalBiotech is in the application phase now for an emergency use authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and is currently offering these products for research use only. CalBiotech is collaborating, however, with partners and government agencies in the U.S. and Brazil to aid in the implementation of these tests. And in addition, CalBiotech is developing a Zika virus diagnostic based on its proprietary magnetic bead platform, which aims to offer enhanced sensitivity to help diagnose and ultimately stem spread of the Zika virus. For more information on this exciting discovery, you can visit calbiotech.com.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show.
We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Donnie Gentile, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.